This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. David Goldfield's been a pretty successful guy, author of 16 books, a history professor at UNC at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte. In fact, a lot of his buddies from Tilden High class of 1961 did pretty well. And he argues that it wasn't only innate talent that created a path to success for him and his baby boomer compatriots. He says the opportunity to achieve was the gift of forward-thinking presidents and administrations who looked out for all Americans. David Goldfield argues that Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Johnson created public policy that sometimes went against public opinion to create a more inclusive and progressive society. He looks back on their administrations in a new book called The Gifted Generation, When Government Was Good, and he joins me now, David Goldfield. Welcome to The State of Things.
Good to be here, Frank.
Tell us about the premise of this this book, this idea that there was a time when we considered government good and there were presidents who argued for it.
In 2011, I went to the 50th high school reunion of my Samuel J. Tilden High School in Brooklyn. And what struck me then was that my peers had evolved into a wide variety of occupations and enjoyed a very rich life, not only in their chosen professions, but also in the arts and culture as well. In fact, most of the careers of my classmates did not exist in 1961. That's how much the economy had changed. But there was one common denominator for all of these people, and that was the fact that the federal government had our backs, in terms of subsidizing our admission and matriculation in college because we were from working-class families. Many of us could not afford full college education, grad school, fellowships, and also the GI Bill helped our parents, and a number of subsidies in terms of infrastructure, in terms of educational supports for infrastructure, and mostly for research. And many of my colleagues pioneered certain innovations and inventions. One of my classmates developed the Intel processor, again, using federal funds. Another one developed the rape kit that's used by law enforcement agencies all across the country, and that also received federal research funds.
So there you are, and you suddenly notice that this undercurrent, this foundation that had gone largely unnoticed by all of us who are beneficiaries of it, us and many, many more, and you decided to sort of document that and take a look back at precisely how the government had been at work in this period and what effects it had.
That's right. Also, I noticed the contrast between my kids growing up and my growing up. In my generation, our fathers and mothers used to say, well, when I was your age, I walked 9 miles through the snow in April, and I had it much much harder than you did. I think we had it much easier. I think we had it much easier than my children and grandchildren have it today. And one of the reasons why we had it much easier is we had government at our backs.
Yeah, and talk about that, because it's interesting to see the evolution of this. You concentrate on the post-World War II years where this really accelerated and where the impact is now quite obvious. But it really has its beginnings in the Depression, where the government has to sort of crack its way into the public sphere with a reluctant FDR, a guy who's going to, you know, gets elected by promising to balance the budget and then says, you know, can't do that.
Well, it was amazing. All three presidents you mentioned, Truman, Eisenhower, and Johnson, were committed to public service, and they came to adulthood and their first jobs during the Great Depression, and they saw what government could do to alleviate the hardships of the Depression. And, of course, Eisenhower was the general in, or commanding general in World War II, and he understood the value of government support, as did Lyndon B. Johnson and Harry Truman. And so they grew up with the idea that government could work as an umpire, that is not catching the fly ball or pitching catching the pitcher, but rather serving to level the playing field to make sure everybody had the opportunity. Now, whether you took that opportunity on. That was up to you. They weren't going to do that for you, but they were going to level the playing field.
And there was public support for this, because part of the effect of leveling the playing field was paving the way for labor to organize and allowing individuals the right to organize and bargain with capital, which, you know, otherwise has extreme leverage. And so workers got it. The idea that government was the problem was not in the mind of Americans. Quite the contrary.
No, not at all. In fact, Dwight D. Eisenhower, if you look through his papers over and over again, he's quoting Abraham Lincoln's dictum on this. And Lincoln said that government must do for the people what the people cannot do for themselves or cannot do well. For themselves. And of course, Eisenhower governed in a very different time from Abraham Lincoln, and he understood that in an industrial and moving to a post-industrial economy, you needed some government to act as the umpire, to make sure that the big business, finance, corporations don't intrude on the rights and privileges of the citizens.
So not only that, so there is a great deal of support, really, for this idea among working-class Americans, but then there were some ideas that received less broad support in the American public, and that was leveling the playing field for all Americans, including minorities.
That's true, and here is a good example of presidents leading. Instead of leading from behind, they led way out in front, because take civil rights, for example. Harry Truman put forth the first civil rights package since the Reconstruction era. It didn't get anywhere. Public support for civil rights was around 6%. And if you took the South out of that, it went up to 21%, but that's not really a majority. The same thing for immigration reform. Harry Truman felt that, hey, we have all these refugees coming from Europe, the war-torn Europe. Let's make it easier for them to come. And, oh, no, we can't do that. They're going to be a tax burden on our economy. Some of them are criminals and communists. And they're also very different. They're Catholic and Jewish. And they won't assimilate well into our society.
So he faces resistance, but he pushes ahead nonetheless. He desegregates the military. And so all of these things are going on. And then when we get to Eisenhower again, Eisenhower, a Republican president, who supports integration and calls out the National Guard.
Yes, he did. Eisenhower always believed in fairness. And he was very frustrated at times with the Republican Party. In fact, early in his administration, he threatened to leave it and either become an independent or join with Democrats. In fact, most of the legislation that he had promoted during his administration, he had to cobble together majorities from progressive Republicans and Northern Democrats, because Southern Democrats and conservative Republicans would not support Eisenhower's programs for immigration, for infrastructure, and for research.
Including universal health care, a proposal he felt very strongly about.
He certainly did. That was actually first proposed by Harry Truman. And the American Medical Association said, oh, no, this is socialized medicine. And you know, we're in the middle of the Cold War, and anything socialist is really bad. Not merely bad, but really bad. And so that never happened. It wasn't a coincidence that when Lyndon Johnson signed Medicare, he went to Independence, Missouri to sign it in front of Harry and Bess Truman. And that was not universal health care.
Not by a long shot. And that had a little more support. I want to get to that in a minute. But I want to get this quote that's in your book. Dwight Eisenhower, again, he proposes universal health care. It's defeated. And he says, quote, "There is nothing to be gained by shutting our eyes to the fact that all our people are not getting the kind of medical care they're entitled to." That is a Republican president using the word entitled and medical care in the same sentence. It's unthinkable now.
It is, particularly.
I mean, or a Democrat, forgive me, but the Democrats don't use
sure,
the word entitled
sure.
anymore, any,
sure,
right?
You're absolutely right, Frank. And again, from Eisenhower's standpoint, we were living in a different era. We were living in an industrial and soon post-industrial era, and people needed the government's help. And if he were right here, he'd jump in and give you that Lincoln quote again.
Tell us now about LBJ, because he does get Medicare through. Medicare and
right.
Medicaid are passed, in his administration. It's a bit of a fight, but it did have more support.
Yeah, it definitely did have more support. Lyndon Johnson was a master at collecting enough people to support his measures, particularly in the Congress and the key committees. He really wanted universal medical care, but that wasn't going to happen. So he got the next best thing. It's the same thing Eisenhower. He wanted stronger civil rights acts, but he got the first Civil Rights Act in 1957 since the Reconstruction era. Our government is based upon compromise, give and take, so this is understandable. And Johnson not only got Medicare, but he also finally ended the really discriminatory quotas on immigrants from Southern and Eastern Europe. After World War II and the dislocations that occurred, Switzerland and Sweden actually took in more refugees than the United States. And that was really a disgrace. And the same arguments were used as are used today. Just substitute Muslim for Catholic or Jewish, and you've got the same thing. Oh, they're criminals. They're going to put too much of a burden on our tax structure. Oh, they're very different, and they're not going to be able to assimilate into American life. I mean, if you read those arguments in the Congress and in the press, it's as if it's 2017.
So, and he's also successful, LBJ, in pushing through a civil rights bill where he famously then loses the South, as he predicted he would.
Right. In 1964, he was instrumental in passing the 64 Civil Rights Act, which ended segregation. When he learned of that Congress had passed the act, he turned to his aide, Bill Moyers, and said, "Bill, I think I've just delivered the South to the Republican Party for a long time to come." And he was absolutely right. And that's really the break in this story, because instead of having a four-party system, that is a conservative and liberal wing of the Democratic Party and a conservative liberal wing of the Republican Party, now the Republican Party takes on the Southern Democrats, who filter out, leave the Democratic Party.
And they didn't have to wait to 64. You know, we remember when a conservative journalist, Robert Novak, was present at the Republican National Committee convention, or a meeting, actually, in Denver. And this was 1963. And they already realized what was happening. Here's the quote. This is Novak's quote. "A good many, perhaps a majority of the party's leadership, envisioned substantial political gold to be mined in the racial crisis by becoming, in fact, if not by name, the white man's party." 1963.
Exactly. And Barry Goldwater said that in 1960. He said, "Let's go hunting where the ducks are," meaning in the South.
Yep. And Goldwater picks up, he loses catastrophically, but picks up key states, South Carolina, Georgia, Mississippi, Louisiana, and Alabama, something that hadn't happened to Republicans in over 100 years.
That's correct.
So it works. And this is the wedge then. Is this what breaks up this coalition of the willing and this understanding that government is good and not bad?
This is one of the things. Race is one of the things. Of course, the other thing was the Vietnam War and then Watergate. So you have a tsunami of negative events and the Arab oil embargo in the early 1970s. What we needed at that time, Frank, we needed a leader to say, "Okay, we've screwed up. We've done these things. We need a new model." Instead, we got Jimmy Carter.
And Jimmy Carter said, "We screwed up. We got to start doing with less." Right?
Tell us the truth. At that time, we didn't need a leader who was smaller than life. Jimmy Carter has had a marvelous post presidency, probably better than any other president out of office. But instead of making government better, he shrunk it. He pushed through deregulation. He hired Paul Volcker as chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, much more concerned about inflation than in boosting the economy. And then, of course, we had the Reagan Revolution in 1980, and that sold Americans that government was not good. Reagan's famous comment was that the nine most worrisome words in the English language are, "Hello, I'm from the government, and I'm here to help." Never realizing the irony that he was presiding over a government that he had just dismissed.
Well, and he had to put a nail in the coffin by saying that government is not the solution, government is the problem, meaning that he understood he was speaking to a coalition of voters, mainly working class whites, who had come to believe that government could solve your problem and was going to bat for you.
Exactly. Theodore Lowy, a political scientist, said that the last Democratic president of the 20th century was Richard Nixon, of course. and he meant by that was that Nixon supported the Environmental Protection Agency. He supported a more progressive tax code. And the presidents subsequent to Nixon were all Republicans, or even if they were Democrats. Bill Clinton is a wonderful example of that. He governed as a moderate Republican. Mm. He deregulated, again, deregulated the economy. He put in a draconian welfare system, among other things. He broke up.
He succeeded where Reagan failed in dismantling welfare, right?
Yeah, and he broke up the Glass-Steagall Act, which eventually paved the way for our economic crisis.
I've only left you 30 seconds for this, but times were getting tough in those days, partly because Europe now and Japan were becoming competitive and the U.S. didn't meet that competition. A lot of bad things happened. But the fact is there were economic anxieties that helped precipitate this. Where are we today? Because we're seeing some of that. And is there a way to sort of turn that around, or are we forever, you know, left with the legacy that government's the problem?
People often point to technology and globalization as things that really impinged upon our ability. My argument in the book is that it nothing to do with that. It's the fact that the government has withdrawn so much from our lives. Not only have they withdrawn, but they've skewed government power to the few well-connected and well-financed. And I think what we need, I know what we need, is better leadership. And as a result of the Trump presidency, perhaps that will generate the resistance and reaction to affect that.
David Goldfield is the Robert Lee Bailey, the Robert Lee Bailey Professor of History at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte, and author of the book, The Gifted Generation, When Government Was Good. He's going to be at the Regulator Bookshop tonight in Durham, North Carolina, and you can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. David, what a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Frank.
State of Things is produced by Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton-Norman, Laura Pelliser, and Jennifer Brookland. Robin Copley's our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.